In this video, we're talking about pride as moral ambitiousness from Chapter 8 of Leonard Peikoff's book, Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. Stay tuned. So let's start with a summary. So pride, like productiveness, is a virtue focused on human creation, but whereas productiveness is focused on the creation of material values, pride is on the creation of spiritual values, the value of your own soul. And so here's how Ayn Rand puts it in The Goal of My Writing. Man faces two corollary, interdependent fields of action in which a constant exercise of choice and a constant creative process are demanded of him, the world around him, and his own soul. Just as he has to produce the material values he needs to sustain his life, so he has to acquire the values of character that enable him to sustain it and that make his life worth living. He has to survive by shaping the world and himself in the image of his values. So pride is the commitment to achieve your moral perfection in order to achieve the best possible spiritual state. So what is moral perfection that we're trying to achieve? It's unbreached rationality. It's consistently choosing to think, to focus our mind, and to live by reason. And so intellectually, it requires working to grasp the demands of a rational morality. It's relentlessly thinking about and asking what really is the good. And then existentially, it means practicing the good, and not just practicing it in kind of isolated snatches. It's practicing it until it becomes second nature, which doesn't mean automatic. It means that it's characteristic of you. It's building into yourself a good moral character. The reward for pride we get is precisely because it is practicing a rational code of morality consistently. It's all of the values that a rational morality makes possible. But there's a special emphasis that we get from Leonard on the value of self-esteem. Remember that we talked about the three cardinal values of objectivism as reason, purpose, and self-esteem, and all of the virtues are necessary to achieve those values. But we've seen the way in which there's a kind of special connection between rationality and reason, between productiveness and purpose, and here we're getting that there's a special connection between pride and self-esteem. And self-esteem, Leonard's the way one of the ways he puts it is, it's I can achieve the best and I deserve the best I can achieve. I am able to live and worthy of living. And that's in essence the objectivist definition of self-esteem. It's the conviction that one is able to live and worthy of living, or worthy of happiness. And we get that self-esteem, to say it's a value is to say that it's not a luxury. It is a vital human need. And the reason that it's a human need is because we are volitional. And a volitional being cannot pursue their self-preservation and happiness as a goal unless they feel qualified. Qualified in the sense that they can fulfill the demanding requirements of self-preservation, and that they're worthy of the goal that they're pursuing. They're worthy of life. So they're qualified both in terms of ability and of value. We also get, though, that self-esteem has to be based on rational standards, that from objectivism, it's unbreached rationality is how we should gauge, am I good or not? Am I able and worthy to live? But that standard is not automatic. Like any emotion, the standards that people can use to evaluate their self-esteem can be wrong. And so often people hold irrational standards, such as the second-hander who says, I'm good because people like me, or I'm good because I sacrifice for others. And there's more understandable kind of cases where people judge themselves by standards that they can't live up to. So if you think about the kind of perfectionist who beats himself up, but he can't actually achieve something that nobody could achieve. Or if you want to connect it to what we talked about in the metaphysical and the man-made, it's often that they are holding themselves to a standard of that which is not open to choice. They're basically rebelling against the metaphysically given. So it's, you have to judge yourself by what's under your volitional control, how you use your mind. And so for objectivism, perfection, the standard of perfection, has to be something that is achievable, that is volitional, that is open to your direct choice, and therefore you can consistently fulfill. We end with an observation that our culture is really anti-pride, that there's a kind of fundamental view that man is low, no one can be fully virtuous, and that we should strive for humility. And this is really an anti-moral view that says, here's the good, but don't practice it, or don't practice it consistently. And that is completely anathema to the objectivist approach, that if you really take morality seriously, part of what it means to say, to take it seriously, is to say that you should practice it, and you should practice it all the time, that you should be not just good, but fully good. So then let's turn to our empire analysis. So the principle, we said, is moral ambitiousness. Intellectually, it's the ambitious pursuit of knowledge. And then existentially, it's using that knowledge to guide your action until the principles of morality become second nature. The metaphysically given fact that's being recognized by pride is that man is a being of self-made soul. So I want to start by talking about the issue of self-esteem, which, as we saw, Leonard spends quite a bit of this section on the virtue of pride talking about. So one of the ways to think about the three cardinal values of objectivism, and again, that's reason, purpose, and self-esteem, is that a lot of human psychology is determined by a person's relationship with these three values, that they hold the key to understanding yourself and understanding other people. So if you think about the value of reason, this is forming our basic relationship to reality and sets the standard, according to objectivism, for even what mental health is. So in, I forget which article it is, but in either the Objectivist or the Objectivist Ethics, or it might even be in Who is Ayn Rand, a book that Nathaniel Brandon published while he was colleagues of Ayn Rand, he defines mental health as the unobstructed capacity for reality-bound cognitive functioning and the exercise of this capacity. Mental illness, by contrast, is the sustained impairment of this capacity. Or if we think about purpose, purpose means to be in control of your mind and your life, and many psychological challenges that people face are really rooted in a feeling of being out of control or attempts to gain control over their life, and sometimes really wrong ways of attempting to gain control over their lives. So you can think about something, if you're at all familiar with obsessive compulsive disorder, a lot of it is a feeling of there's things out there that are threatening that I don't feel in control of. And then you have certain kind of rituals and practices that are kind of attempts to quell that anxiety and gain some sense of control, even though it's not a real form of control. And so in terms of purpose, the way Ayn Rand kind of elaborates this point is, if you recall our discussion, essential purpose, she talks about how that serves to integrate all the concerns of our lives, establishes a hierarchy of values. But she talks about, you know, a person with out purpose is lost in chaos. He does not know what his values are. He does not know how to judge. He cannot tell what is or is not important to him, and therefore he drips helplessly at the mercy of any chance stimulus or any whim of the moment. He can enjoy nothing. He spends his life searching for some value which he will never find. So the idea is that a person's relationship to purpose is going to make a fundamental difference in the kind of person that he or she is. And so if we turn to self-esteem then this determines whether you are confident in the power of your tool of survival, and therefore whether or not you feel entitled to the happiness that comes from using it, or whether you'll be crippled by self-doubt and self-hatred. And so it will determine whether you're focused on pursuing goals and achieving values, or whether you're obsessed with escaping fear and guilt. So here's how Brandon puts it in one of his articles on self-esteem. An emotion is the product of an evaluation. It reflects an appraisal of the beneficial or harmful relationship of some aspect of reality to oneself. Thus, a man's view of himself is necessarily implicit in all value responses. Any judgment entailing the issue, is this for me or against me, entails a view of the me involved. His self-evaluation is an omnipresent factor in man's psychology. The nature of his self-evaluation has profound effects on a man's thinking process, emotions, desires, values, and goals. It is the single most significant key to his behavior. To understand a man psychologically, one must understand the nature and degree of his self-esteem and the standards by which he judges himself. And so, why is self-esteem so important? Why is objectivism regarded as kind of the central issue in human psychology, or at least Rand and Brandon certainly think about it that way? Leonard explains the root issue when he says a volitional being cannot accept self-preservation as his purpose unless taking a moral inventory. He concludes he is qualified for the task, qualified in terms of ability and value. And so if you think about ability, think of when you procrastinate. And sometimes it's that the task is simply unpleasant, you know, like going to the DMV, I don't want to do that. But often it's because of a fear that you can't do what it is you're supposed to do. And so your mind, it rebels, your mind's rebelling at doing something that seems really fruitless. And so it's, if you think about how that kind of procrastination can hold you back, whereas if you felt totally confident that, all right, I can tackle this demanding challenge, you're far less likely to procrastinate, which means you're far more likely to tackle and achieve that challenge and waste a lot less time doing it. You're more efficacious because you believe you are efficacious, or you have that conviction that you're efficacious. In terms of value, I mean, you can think about the kind of example of, you know, you see an attractive man or woman, assuming you're single, and if you don't feel worthy of them for some reason, and maybe it's kind of a fundamental unworthiness, but even just take something a little bit less kind of fundamentally psychological, but just like, you know, you're not dressed very well, and, you know, your friends dragged you out to like some fancy place and you just feel out of place, or, you know, any sort of dynamic like that where you feel like, all right, I'm not up to this person that I'm approaching, you're not going to approach, and you're going to potentially miss out on a big value. So it's in not feeling worthy, you're not going to take certain actions, or even assuming you do take certain actions. I mean, one of the dynamics in relationships, forget approaching the person, is people will end up in relationships where they don't feel worthy of someone. They end up pushing them away and sabotaging the relationship. And even though they had a chance at that value and even had it for a while, they couldn't enjoy it and they couldn't sustain it because they didn't feel worthy of it. So to take actions that your life and happiness requires, you need to feel able to achieve the goals that you set out to achieve and worthy of achieving them and worthy of the happiness that comes from achieving them. Otherwise, you won't act, you'll lower your sights, you'll self-sabotage, and so this is the core of your need for self-esteem. So how do you achieve it? The simplest issue is by understanding what morality does and doesn't demand and practicing the virtues. Now, there's a caveat to that, and we've talked about this before in various ways, but it's that a perfectly moral person can still suffer from self-esteem challenges. Because of psychological problems usually developed when you're young, and probably things that I don't even know about or haven't thought about, but there's things outside of your control that I think can influence your level of self-esteem. And so in that case, I don't think that morality alone or philosophy alone can give you unpreached self-esteem. What it can do is allow you to kind of max out that which is open to you absent other avenues. So it's to get the most out of what's available to you, morality is going to give you that. And, you know, hopefully you can find the tools to deal with whatever kind of psychological issues, or if they're kind of underlying biological, physiological things that play into it, which I have no clue about. Hopefully there's tools for that. But the point is that, like, whatever potential self-esteem you have, the only way to fully achieve that or enact that or make that real is by consistently practicing the virtues, by practicing, in this case, the the special focus is on the virtue of pride. And so the way to kind of think about it, I think, is that self-esteem is not all or nothing. It's not like you got 100 or you got a zero. And so any marginal gain that you can get is enormously valuable. I want to turn now to a concept in objectivism of pseudo self-esteem. So and I'll set it up this way. In Ankar Gatte's chapter one of his chapters in the Blackwell Companion to Ayn Rand, he has a piece called Self-Made Soul. And he argues that, quote, Rand envisions three basic possibilities for the creation of self-esteem, which admit of much variation within them. And so the first is the person basically of unbreached rationality, rather, who judges himself by the correct moral standard. So it's you, in practice, live a fully rational life, and you're judging yourself by fully rational standards. And so that's full self-esteem. The second is the person who is fully rational, but judges himself by, as Ankar puts it, improper metaphysical or moral standards. And so you can think of the perfectionist, as we talked about, or you can think of Hank Reardon from Atlas Shrugged, where he's judging himself in part by society's moral standards, and he doesn't fully agree with them, but he can't reject them. He thinks there's something right about them, or something at least that he doesn't know how to challenge. And so it's not that his self-esteem is absent. Indeed, he feels a tremendous amount of self-efficacy of his ability to cope with the challenges of reality, but his self-esteem is impaired because he doesn't feel fully worthy of the happiness that he is morally entitled to. And then the third, Ankar argues, is the person who's characteristically irrational. And the way Ankar puts it is the consequent experiences of metaphysical self-doubt and moral guilt are intolerable. Rand argues, therefore, that individuals who fail to earn genuine self-esteem fake its possession. They erect some form of pseudo self-esteem. And I think the concept of pseudo self-esteem is one of the most pregnant ideas in objectivism, or I don't even know if you would include it in objectivism, but to come out of the objectivist view of the world. And I mean, the idea is all over Ayn Rand's novels, though the main theoretical source is from the Objectivist newsletter, a two-part article by Nathaniel Brandon called Pseudo Self-Esteem. So Brandon puts it this way: pseudo self-esteem, an irrational pretense at self-value, is an neurotic device to diminish anxiety and provide a spurious sense of security, to assuage a man's need of authentic self-esteem while allowing the real causes of its lack to be evaded. A man's pseudo self-esteem is maintained by two means: by evading and repressing ideas and feelings that could affect his self-appraisal adversely, and by seeking to derive his sense of self-efficacy and worth from something other than rationality, some alternative value or virtue which he experiences as less demanding or more easily attainable, such as doing one's duty, or being stoical, or altruistic, or financially successful, or sexually attractive. And so you can see how it's anything that you can plug in for, I'm good because. And then if you just think about all the people you see, you can get a sense of what really makes somebody tick is they're like, I'm good because, and they probably can't articulate it. But if you think about like Peter Keating, it's I'm good because people approve of me. Or if you think of Ellsworth Tui, it's I'm good because I have power over others. And, if it's, I'm going blank on her name, but one of the Ivy Stars, it's I'm good because I'm spiritual, not material. So there's all kinds of forms of pseudo self-esteem that people can set up. And the essential issue is that a person sets up a clash between, or the essential problem really, is that a person sets up a clash between perceiving reality and preserving a self-esteem. And you can think from the objectivist perspective, it's achieving self-esteem is fidelity to reality, but pseudo self-esteem is all about something, is when you're, what is, holding up your pretense at self-esteem is put above reality. And reality becomes a threat to your sense of self-esteem. And as an aspect of having this clash between perceiving reality and preserving self-esteem, this kind of person with pseudo self-esteem sets up a clash between pursuing values and preserving his self-esteem, between pursuing real values, things that actually are good for his life, and his self-esteem. Because what he pursues aren't genuine values. It's to the extent that he's operating on sustaining a phony self-esteem, he's seeking what Brandon calls defense values that ward off fear or guilt. So they're not positives. When Peter Keating is trying to get somebody's approval, it's not any real value. It's not something that actually makes his life better. What it does is it gives him, it wards off his sense of fear that he's no good, and his fear of living by his independent judgment. And so Brandon puts it this way: the principle that distinguishes the basic motivation of a man of self-esteem from that of a man of pseudo self-esteem is the principle of motivation by love versus motivation by fear, which we talked a little bit about in the past video. And again, I think it'll come up more later in Opar, I think in the chapter on happiness. But one way to think about the contrast between self-esteem versus pseudo self-esteem is, I mean, you can almost think about it graphically, like in terms of, you know, one of the, a line graph is, if you're run by pseudo self-esteem, you'll have these wild swings. It's like, I'm amazing because I got somebody's approval, or it's I'm nothing because I got, you know, criticized or something like this. And it's just up and down. I'm amazing because I got a girl in bed, and I'm a complete loser because I got rejected. It's, you know, I got my name in the paper for writing a big check to a charity, and it's, you know, the next morning when I wake up and look around and feel lonely and guilty for being rich, and whatever the case may be. Whereas a person of high self-esteem, by contrast, they'll have up and down variation in how they feel about themselves. And occasionally there can be a huge breakthrough where they feel incredibly, you know, and kind of rise in confidence. I mean, you can think about a very confident person who like successfully runs a first marathon, and there's a real sense of triumph there where you get kind of a bigger jolt than usual. And sometimes there'll be, you know, a huge letdown, like maybe they make an out of character bad choice that, you know, they really kind of disappointed a friend or something like that. But in general, their kind of basic orientation about themselves is going to stay within a pretty narrow band. And Gary Vaynerchuk, who's like a marketing business expert that I really like, he talks about how he makes it a conscious policy not to buy into the nice things that people say about him, which is his secret to not being affected by the mean things. And I think there's kind of a similar issue here, is that you're trying to judge yourself based on reality and not be, and the result of that is that you'll have ups and downs, but not these enormous ones that come ultimately from pseudo self-esteem. So this is just a rich topic, and I mean, basically my goal here is to just put it on your radar screen and say, hey, learn more about this and think more about this. And I would start with Brandon's articles, which I think give a lot of really good leads. And then it's helpful, I think, to read Ayn Rand's books from this perspective. And then I talked about kind of the cognitive behavioral therapy approach, and in particular, Judith Beck's work. And she talks about kind of core values, and often, and I think there's even discussions of defense values in there, but I think in that whole school of psychology, you get a lot of these ideas explored in various ways, albeit using different terminology. So let's turn then to the issue of perfection, which is, I think, often sets off alarm bells for people. And I mean, I've struggled with this concept myself, because I mean, I think the basic argument is unassailable, right? It's, if you have standards of perfection that are attainable, and if there's nothing to gain from imperfection, from making bad choices, well then, yeah, morality demands perfection, and it's the to be expected from yourself. And I think that argument is flawless. And I think ultimately that argument is true. But on the other hand, it has always struck me as a little bit playing with fire, in that it can encourage kind of all or nothing thinking, and even motivation by fear, which is, oh my God, like, can't violate my moral principles or I won't be perfect. And to put it even more provocatively, I think there can even be sort of a tension, though I don't think a real contradiction, but I do think that there can be a sort of tension between Ayn Rand's view of pride and the importance of moral perfection and the view that she sketches, the way that she treats morality and causality versus duty, where you shouldn't be focused on like your moral character in a vacuum, but on like, am I good or am I not good, but on the values you want to achieve, and then the cause and effect necessary in order to achieve them. So that said, I prefer, though I'm not going to stand by this as fully philosophically rigorous without more thought, but as a general rule, the way I actually think of perfection is more as an active verb rather than a noun. It's really an issue of perfecting, of making more and more perfect. It's of not, I think the key idea, and this I am confident in, the real key idea is not resigning yourself to character flaws, but always being on the premise of improvement. The question to ask yourself is not like, am I perfect? I mean, it's rather, am I getting better? Am I eagerly looking for ways to understand morality better and practice it more consistently? It's a real enthusiasm for moral knowledge, including of identifying like moral gaps in yourself and doing what you can to improve them. So that's why I say it's perfecting. It's not settling for less than the best you can achieve. You know, it's, again, it's not an all or nothing, oh, I've lost my perfection and now this is, you know, going to, you know, destroy me and everything. It's much more a positive, a real enthusiasm of improvement. So if you think about the issue that way, discovering moral flaws isn't a threat. It's a value. I mean, having them is bad, but discovering them is a real value because it's a chance to improve. And if you take an analogy to creative work, right? If you're trying to develop a creative skill set, like I'm, you know, trying to become a novelist, or you're working on a particular creative project, like writing a particular novel, then it's not like you want to kind of protect your image of yourself as, oh, I'm a great novelist, so I don't want people to tell me about flaws in my work. That's going to prevent you from being able to do the best work you can do. And so your attitude properly should be, I want to constantly identify where I can get better, where I'm making mistakes. And I think the same kind of attitude should be cultivated in the area of moral character, that instead of like obsessing about, oh my God, am I imperfect? It should be obsessing about, oh my, where can I improve? A little bit more on how to deal with moral failings when you find them. So if you think about how we're typically taught to deal with moral failings, it's through confession and apology. It's, I did this, I admit it, and I'm sorry. And for objectivism, just as morality is primarily cognitive, so is rectifying moral flaws. So this is the advice Leonard gives. If, however, in a moment of weakness, he, you know, a person who's trying to be moral, does earn some moral guilt, he acts decisively to clean the slate and restore his moral purity. He condemns his improper behavior, analyzes its roots, identifying in the process the underlying evasions, makes reparation where applicable, and works to reshape his mental policy. He thereby retrains his character for the future. So why is this advice helpful? Well, from objectivism's perspective, the immoral is self-destructive, like it's bad for you. But it's self-destructive in the full context. To take a self-destructive action is only possible because you don't make the full context of the choice fully real to yourself. So, for example, to go back to an example we talked about under honesty, you know, your friend asks, am I overweight? Could I stand to lose a few pounds? And you respond with a white lie. No, you look fine, even though they could definitely lose 20 pounds. Like if you take that kind of case, the full context of that action, like if you really are in focus and thinking about it, would be you're not helping your friend. And since your friend probably knows that, yeah, I am overweight, now they trust you less, even if they feel like, oh, he or she reassured me. They know that they cannot fully trust you to tell them the truth anymore. And since you were willing to deny the truth, you trust yourself less. And so you're harming your values because you're placing your feelings and your friend's feelings above the facts. Now, if all you did in that kind of case was experience a pang of guilt and come back the next day and say, actually, I lied. You could stand to lose some weight. I'm sorry. Well, that's great. Like, I mean, at least you're acknowledging reality, but you're still being guided by your feelings. Only now it's the feeling of guilt instead of the feeling of discomfort, right? And so what are you going to do, and what are you going to trust yourself to do next time you're in that uncomfortable situation? Now contrast that with with actually conceptualizing the issue. Okay, I was acting in the premise that it's wrong to name facts if they give rise to uncomfortable feelings in me or in others. Well, why is that? And you might think, oh, well, maybe it's I fear people will think I'm cruel or they won't like me. But then you would check that and say, well, no, look, when I lie, I hurt my friends, I lose the respect, I lose my self-respect. And then you come up with a strategy. You know, next time I feel discomfort in that kind of situation, that'll be, you know, a signal to remind myself, like, no, I need to tell the truth. And if I can't bring myself to do that for some reason, maybe I'll just say, like, I don't feel comfortable answering that question or answering that kind of question. And I'm not saying, like, that's the full analysis one should do. And I mean, you could ultimately go very deep, potentially, where you can identify perhaps even kind of like, you know, very deep psychological and developmental roots. But it's that kind of thinking. If you just take it that much, which approach do you think will actually lead to improvement versus the just sheer, like, I did it, I'm sorry, which again, better than nothing. But there's just so much we can do cognitively with a bad choice that will really help us regain our confidence and make better decisions going forward. Though I want to say a little bit more about the nature of moral failings in general, because I said almost in passing, I think that a moral failing or a bad moral choice amounts to not seeing things in the full context. And that's not quite right, because what it assumes is that we all automatically want to do what's good for us. And it's just an issue of bringing that knowledge into full awareness, and then we'll automatically do it. But that's not true. And we've gone into great depth in past videos about how not everybody wants to live. And you can put it even differently. Not everybody and not every moment is choosing to live. And I want to expand a little bit on this part of it. When we do something immoral, there's really two possibilities that are on the table. So the first is that we haven't brought into full awareness the link between virtues and values. We're not fully seeing with clarity that, say, being honest is, in this particular case, the best policy for my life. But we can also be rejecting in that moment happiness is our goal. It's, yeah, I know that by my that standing by my virtues will be the best for me in the long term, but I'd rather avoid the short-term pain. And I think you can see how when you put it that way, like, that can be way more common. Like, if you put it as rejecting happiness as the goal or rejecting the choice to live, people go, yeah, that doesn't really make sense. But if you think about it more in terms of, are there people who will reject long-term happiness in order to avoid short-term pain, you can think, well, yeah, like, and I mean, I've definitely done that. And you can think about the way it stands in a person's mind is, it's like, I'd rather settle for being less happy and fulfilled than, like, I mean, for example, like admit to my boss that I made a mistake that cost the company hundreds of thousands of dollars, or, you know, I'd settle for being less happy than to tell my spouse that, you know, I'm unhappy in the marriage, or that I'd rather settle for being less happy than deal with the embarrassment of like admitting, you know, I suffer from anxiety or depression. Like there's a million things where you have to endure kind of a short-term, usually emotional negative in order to stay committed to a long-term vision of happiness. And that is definitely something that one can surrender, even if one maintains the knowledge that, yes, this is going to cost me long-term happiness. So part of moral ambitiousness, part of making perfection our goal, is refusing to make that trade-off. It's refusing to settle for less than the best possible spiritual state in exchange for pushing off some short-term feeling of embarrassment or shame or fear or whatever the emotion is that you're placing above happiness. I want to talk a little bit about humility. And Leonard attacks humility, and yet people think of humility as a virtue. And so I want to get clear in kind of what objectivism isn't saying here. So Leonard is using humility in its strict philosophic sense. So this is a definition of humble that comes from the Oxford English Dictionary, though I didn't look it up there. This is quoted by Tara Smith in a really good analysis of humility that she has in her book, Ayn Rand's Normative Ethics. But so quoting from the dictionary, it's to have a low estimate of one's importance, worthiness, or merits, marked by the absence of self-assertion or self-exaltation, lowly, the opposite of proud. And so Tara goes on to explain, one of the points she makes is that we have to distinguish humility, that kind of opposite of proud, the absence of self-assertion, belief in one's importance. We have to distinguish that from modesty, which just means like not being pretentious, not being a show-off who goes around saying, hey guys, I'm amazing and awesome. And maybe this will be helpful, and this may be a modest statement, we'll see. But like, I used to date girls who would say stuff like, oh, I'm so amazing and I'm awesome, because I thought, whoa, that's such a sign of self-confidence and self-esteem. And I think it took me a few rounds to realize that, no, it's often the opposite. I think a person of self-esteem will not deny their legitimate achievements and goodness, but they definitely don't go around talking about how amazing they are. That's usually a sign of self-doubt. That said, I don't even think modesty is an unqualified virtue. A person should be realistic about their strengths and weaknesses and their, you know, failures and their achievements. And I actually think that the best people that I've met typically have an arrogant streak, at least when they're young. And I think it's good that they have this. And so if you think about the position of like a 22-year-old, right? They're about to go out, and if they're at all ambitious, like they want to have an impact on the world. And they haven't been tested yet. They don't really know what they're made of and what they can accomplish, because they haven't really accomplished anything yet. I mean, they very likely know that they're more intelligent than the people around them. They're more thoughtful. They're more creative in certain ways. But they don't really have a sense of what their limits are and how they fit into the world as a whole. And so, like, they better damn well have an exaggerated sense of their abilities if they're going to achieve everything that they're capable of achieving. Like, if you don't run into a wall and go, oh, maybe I'm not as capable as I thought, well, then you're not going to be as capable as you can be. And so I think modesty actually properly and rationally comes from experience. It's discovering over time the true limits of our abilities. So here's my rule of thumb, which is that a person of genuine self-esteem will very likely be arrogant at 20 and modest at 50. And a person of low self-esteem will often be modest at 20 and arrogant at 50. Some practical advice. I mean, I think this has been a very practical topic. So I'll just end by reading what is my all-time favorite Ayn Rand quote, which is on pride. Pride is the recognition of the fact that you are your own highest value, and like all man's values, it has to be earned. That of any achievements open to you, the one that makes all others possible is the creation of your own character. That your character, your actions, your desires, your emotions are the product of the premises held by your mind. And just as man must produce the physical values he needs to sustain his life, so he must acquire the values of character that make his life worth sustaining. That as man is a being of self-made wealth, so he is a being of self-made soul. That to live requires a sense of self-value, but man who has no automatic values has no automatic sense of self-esteem and must earn it by shaping his soul in the image of his moral ideal. In the image of man, the rational being, he is born able to create, but must create by choice. That, the first precondition of self-esteem, is the radiant selfishness of soul, which desires the best in all things, in matters, in values of matter and spirit, a soul that seeks above all else its own moral perfection, valuing nothing higher than itself. So that's it for this video. Be sure to like it, subscribe to the YouTube channel, and as always, the best way to stay in contact is to go to donswriting.com and sign up for the newsletter. Talk next time.